one of the key things of those days, certainly amongst this, what I would regarded then as an inner circle, was we were sublimely confident of the importance of our work, and we regarded ourselves as like Chekhovian in importance. If anyone at the BBC would dare to say you change this, change that, we would just tear off a strip at them.
Welcome to GoomPod, the podcast that keeps me busy and off the streets, thus in its own way providing a public service. My name is Tyler Adams, and this week I'm afraid to say I'm joined once again by the writer Mike Haskins.
Thank you, Tyler. Hello. Thank you for having me back on your lovely podcast, which I love listening to every week. It's great.
Thank you for that. So, Mike, you've been busy. I mean, you've got...
Yeah, are you going to ask me what I've been up to?
What have you been up to?
Very little. Well, it's Griff is on tour, so I don't know when this is going out, but he's on tour in he's been on tour in April, and he's still on tour in May. Check local press for details. So I've been helping him a little bit with that. It's not
this
a
is
huge...
this is Griff Rees-Jones.
Griff Rees-Jones. Like, yes.
Mike is what's your title? Script associate?
Well,
no.
You know how Spike said about Larry that best pay. In fact, no, I'm not even the best paid typist in the business. I'm the worst paid type. Anyway, and now, guess what? He comes on, and this is in his show. He comes on and does this routine about AI and whatever, and how hilarious this is. And he reads out a bit of, you know, he gets an AI kind of, you know, chat GPT. Actually, spoiler alert, listeners, I have to do this for him. I have to do ChatGPT, and he does a sort of routine that ChatGPT has written for him for the place he's in that day, and he makes fun of it and everything. Right, so he does all this about how AI is rubbish and everything, and then he's actually replaced me with AI, because I used to go along, this is literally true, I used to go along and type up everything that he said, and then, you know, like in the show. If you've got an audio file of it, then it's just sort of difficult. But then I would write it all up and present it to him and do sort of, you know, bullet points and, you know, this joke you did here and blah, 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 and do, you know, kind of a long version and a shorter version of the show and everything. Anyway, he's found an AI program which does a transcript automatically, which is absolutely brilliant. Anyway, I'm sure there'll be other bits and pieces. I generally help him. It's not a big thing. I'm not doing... You know, he can do it all himself, obviously. He's brilliant, and he's got all these stories. He's really good. But he likes a little bit of, you know, encouragement, shall we say, and a few extra jokes here and there, so I do that. And I've been doing my Beatles Liverpool talks. They go down very well. As I was telling you before we started, Griff did his first night in Guildford. He was only playing a tiny place because it was the first night of his tour. It was a tryout, but I was very pleased to be able to tell him that day I had played to a bigger audience at Heswell Hall that day myself doing my Beatles Liverpool talk. However, the last laugh was on me actually, because I went on too long. And usually, you know, it's quite good doing these Beatles talks because they quite enjoy it, these people. And then they all come and buy your book afterwards, so it's great. But however, I went on a bit too long. So do you know what that meant? It meant all these people made a dash for the door at the end because they were all in the pay and display car park and they needed to...
So no books.
I only sold about 4 books. It was tragic. Terrible.
God.
So I won't let that happen again.
Yeah, okay. I've got this image in my mind. You know, when you talk about you and Griff...
Yes,
and this is going to be really insulting, and I apologise in advance. But do you remember that? Do you remember Alexei Sayle's stuff?
Yeah, with Stephen Lewis.
Yeah, with Bobby Chariot, the failed. Not that Griff's a failed comic, I hasten to add, but Bobby Chariot's this kind of third rank comedian, and Stephen Lewis, aka Blakey from On the Buses, is his script.
It's very much the way I feel. Yeah. However, Stephen Lewis wrote that film, didn't he, with Barbara Windsor?
Sparrows can't sing.
Sparrows can't sing. Isn't that Stephen Lewis?
I think you might be right.
So he is a fine writer, Blakey from On the Buses. So he was in with the what's the name of that woman
and
the
Littlewood.
Joan Littlewood,
yeah.
All those people. Harry H. Corbett is in it as well, doesn't he?
So and George and Mildred.
So they're all in that. Yeah.
Uther and Brian, I mean.
Yeah. What are we talking about today? I think we're talking about other left-wing leaning comedy collectives, aren't we? Speaking of Joan Littlewood.
Well, that a lovely segue. Okay. Well, let me begin by just reading. There's a from November 1954. An advert appeared in the newspaper. I'm not sure which newspaper.
No.
Possibly the Evening Standard, I'm not sure. But it says, employment agency license. We, Terence Allen Milligan, known as Spike Milligan, Raymond Percy Galton, known as Ray Galton.
Percy's a surprise there, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. I wasn't expecting the Percy. Eric Sykes and Alan Francis Simpson intend to apply to the London County Council for a license to carry on an employment agency for all persons in the entertainment industry, including cinema artists, at 130 Uxbridge Road, London W12, such agency to be known as Associated London Scripps.
When do you say that appeared? When did that appear?
Apparently, according to my notes, November 1954.
Oh, that's interesting because I thought they didn't actually come up with the name until Beryl joined them, although we are already getting ahead of ourselves. But let's just park that for a moment. So, yes, there they are. November 1954. Yeah. So Associated London Scripts. And four extraordinary writers all come together to form what Spike said was going to be a writer's cooperative, didn't he? A writer's commune. Yeah. Do you think it was a writer's commune, a writer's really. Cooperative? It was. How would you define a writer's cooperative, do you think, Tyler? If you had to put it into words, what would you say? How would you define a cooperative?
Everyone's on an equal footing. Everyone's paying in the same or taking out the same. Is that?
Well,
and sharing everything.
I'll tell you how I'd define a cooperative. I promise you, I haven't looked this up or anything, but I would probably define a cooperative as a business or other organisation which is owned and run jointly by its members who share the profits or benefits and who then give out co-op dividend stamps. So it's pretty much the same as you said, actually. It starts off as Spike says this, but that is not the way it turns out. But let's talk through it. They start at 130 Uxbridge Road, which is a greengrocer's in Shepherd's Bush.
Is this why Steptoe and Son is set in Shepherd's Bush?
Very possibly.
Galton and Simpson were writing it there.
Were there some toilets on Shepherd's Bush Green where Wilfred Bramble got caught? isn't that a true story? He got nabbed by the Rozzers.
He did.
He was up to no good. Very possibly. Just put in the names of the places where you live, and it's always funny, isn't it? But
Let me just say, because in case there's anyone listening who are unaware, and I'm sure that nobody listening to this podcast is unaware of Associated London Scripps, but like you say, it was let's call it a writer's collective.
Yeah.
Set up by Spike and Eric with Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, and Frankie Howard was there.
Frankie Howard
as well.
Frankie Howard and his manager Scruffy Dale, Stanley Dale, who Spike did not like at all.
What did he say about Scruffy Dale? He apparently lost a testicle during the war while in the RAF, and Spike. Spike observed that he hoped he'd dropped it over Treston.
How many people did... Because that happened to Frank Muir as well, didn't it? Genuinely.
Did it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Frank Muir lost a testicle in the... So there's a very funny story in his autobiography, which I recommend highly to anyone. You must have read it, Tyler. Tell me you've read
Kentish Lad.
Yes, it's a really great book. It's lovely. Mm. But I think it was from drinking unpasteurised milk or something. Is that what happens to you if you drink unpasteurized milk? Anyway, so he'd lost this testicle in the war.
Standing too close to a Spitfire propeller.
Well, maybe. Yeah, after drinking his... Maybe that's when he was drinking the milk. But then a few years later, he was at a party or something, and he was making some woman laugh, you know, and she was laughing, you know, uproariously at Frank being funny. And in the end, she said, "Oh, stop it, Frank, you're diabolical." And he said, "No, actually, madam, I am monobolical." Brilliant, isn't it? Maybe he had that one saved up, waiting for the day. But he was very good, Frank Muir. I rate him very, very highly. Just one of the great British comedy writers with Dennis Norden before you got any of this goons nonsense and everything. It was Muir and Norden that Galton and Simpson really looked up to. And yeah, I think Spike should have probably did as well. But, you know, and obviously, you know, they wrote, what's it? Well, as well as Take It From Here.
Third Division.
Which, of course, we get the classic Sellers sketch, Balham Gateway to the South, which is about all that survives of that series. Yeah. Anyway, back to the subject. So we're talking about Associated London scripts. So yeah, they start off as, you know, Spike saying it's going to be a writers' cooperative and whatever, writers' commune, but it becomes a management agency. And I suppose the point is that back at this time, so we're talking about the early mid-50s, you know, this whole kind of ecosystem that we have now, which I have never managed to break into properly with agents and whatever, and writers getting contracts and things, that didn't really exist, certainly not for comedy writers. So Spike and Eric come up with this thing, but the predecessor, speaking of, you know, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, was a thing called Ted Kavner Associates, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Kavner was, of course, the writer of Itmar. Yeah. And also, he was a very decent man. Where was he from, Tyler? Do you know?
I'm guessing he was from my part of the world.
He was. He was from New Zealand. And right. he'd come in. I think he might have been a doctor or something.
That's no guarantee of quality.
But anyway, Frank Muir started up. Ted Kavner had founded this Kavner Associates in 1945, and Frank Muir sent in material to him, and so Ted Kavner got him to write some material for a clarinetist who wanted to become a comedian, but then the clarinetist changed his mind, and but Ted paid Frank Muir the £20 anyway. £20 in those days. Whoa. Wow. He was a devout Catholic as well, Ted Kavner.
You could buy a football club with that sort of money, couldn't you?
So it was Ted Kavner from Itmar, who paired up Frank Muir with Dennis Norden. So he actually put them together as writers because I don't think they really knew each other before that. And the other thing I should say about all this, listeners, is that I did a programme about Associated London Scripts 20 years ago on Radio 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting to do because I got to meet all these amazing people like Galton and Simpson and John Antrobus. So we spoke to, so that was all absolutely brilliant. But I actually had an agent myself at the time. And after I'd done this program, I said to him, you know, we should do a book on this. We could do a book on Associated London Scripts. And he did precisely nothing. And then just a few months later, Graham McCann, who writes lots of wonderful books about comedy, and he's very, very good, but he nipped in there and he did the book about Associated London Scripts, so that was quite frustrating, but I'm sure he did a much better job than I would have done. But anyway, I know
not at all. The book is Spike and Co, which Spike and Co. I have in my hand.
Right, so we recommend it, but if only I'd got to do mine. But anyway, I suppose Associated London Scripts, really, it starts with Sykes.
I keep trying to make this plain, but Frank would never have it. He discovered me. I was a jobbing repertory actor, of which there were thousands. He was the biggest thing in the country.
And I think maybe of all of them, you know, he's the one whose star has maybe waned slightly and people know slightly less about him.
Yeah.
But in the late 40s, early 50s, I mean, he was just the biggest, best comedy writer in Britain. And then he became a massive figure on TV in the 60s and 70s. But I looked him up on Wikipedia. Wikipedia says, Sykes first came to prominence through his many radio credits as a writer and actor in the 1950s, most notably through his collaboration on the Goon Show scripts. Did you write this, Tyler? Did you put this on Wikipedia?
No.
No. No.
But I dispute that he's most famous for...
Yeah, this is absolute nonsense. Yeah, he did do some Goon Show scripts, but he was a huge figure before that.
Yeah.
So when they start, you know...
Sorry to interrupt there, because I read something in preparation for this last week. I can't remember what it was. I think it was like a newspaper report from around the time, from around the mid-50s, where it essentially said that Sykes was better known than Milligan around that time.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Arguably the best established and best regarded of the four who started Associated London Scripts. I mean, Spike was sort of pretty well established, wasn't he? Because so Associated London Scripts, if it starts, really they all start about September 1954. That's when the four of them, Sykes, Milligan, Galton and Simpson, they all get together and, you know, we're now a thing. And then they place your advert, you said, in November 54. So
to put it in context, September 54 was just about the beginning of the fifth series of The Goon Show, which is what we now know to be sort of the beginning, really, of The Goon Show as we know it.
And that's what I think is interesting, that it's exactly at that time, you know, that because also it's the time when Milligan has just fallen out with Larry in the previous series, and Larry's just gone off and isn't really involved now. So I think, you know, and now he's moved. It's like Spike has left Larry for another woman. He's moved in with Eric Sykes in the greengrocers, because Eric Sykes had these offices above this greengrocer, right? But there's a nice little story in Graham McCann's book about Sykes, just to show how important he was. And he says, the BBC pulled some strings with the GPO to make sure that Sykes was one of the first civilians in London after the war to get a private telephone. That is how important he was, because, you know, the BBC needed to get hold of him in a hurry. And so Sykes is some years younger than Milligan, isn't he? He's 5 years younger. Born in Oldham. Yeah. His mum dies while giving birth to him, although Wikipedia says she dies 3 weeks later. So it was a long birth. Then in the war...
Well, at least it was there, not 3 weeks before.
3 weeks before, oh dear. And he was in...
Sorry, listeners.
He was in a review during the war called Three Bags Full. Bags of what was not specified. Also in that show were Dennis Norden and Bill Fraser. So, you know, this is interesting that they're all together in a thing during the war. Mm-hmm. Bill Fraser. Do people know who Bill Fraser is now? He was... Some will recognise
Bootsy and Snudge.
Bootsy and Snudge. He was in the Army Game, because originally Bootsy and Snudge were two characters in the Army Game, weren't they?
Yeah.
I guess Bill Fraser was the officer guy. And then the Army Game, created and written by Sid Collin, of course, from Kavanagh's. The great Sid Collin.
And also written by Larry Stevens, Morris Wiltshire.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of these Associated London Scripts people that we will come on to, John Entrebus and so on. So, very important. And the other thing I was thinking about this, because the Army Game, that starts in 1958. And then a year later, you get the Navy Lark. It just never occurred to me before. You know, the Navy Lark is a rip-off of the Army Game, isn't it? It's like the same title. But the Navy Lark still lives forever because it's on Radio 4 Extra every week, whereas the Army Game is ancient history because it was on ITV and it's never been, or no one's seen it since, you know, whatever, 1961 or something.
Was there a RAF version of, like, a RAF comedy?
Well, do you know what? There was Get Some In. That was some while later in the 1970s with Robert Lindsay
and Tony Selby.
Yes, that is right. And I remember watching that at the time. It had quite a rude joke in it, which was along the lines of, I have not seen this in, when was Get Some In on? About 50 years ago or something. Getting on for 50 years ago. So... there's something about, you know, Robert Lindsay's character tells the Tony Selby character that he's going to see a girl tonight. And so, what do you want to do that for? And Tony Selby has got a biro in his hand. And Robert Lindsay takes the pen and points it upwards as his answer. That was the most disgusting thing I'd ever seen on television.
Right. He was going to go around to do some scribbling.
That's right, yes, yes. That's obviously what he was, yeah. So, yes, Dennis Auden, Bill Fraser and Eric Sykes. And, yeah, so Bill Fraser was the concert party officer. So then Bill Fraser went on to marry somebody from another famous military sitcom. Do you know who it was? Pamela Cundell.
Mrs. Fox.
Mrs. Fox from Dad's Army. So Bill Fraser was married to her. But the interesting thing is they didn't get married until 1981. So he was 73 and she was 61. What they've been doing the previous...
Were they living over the brush or whatever they call it? Were they living in sin?
I don't know. I do not know. But I just thought that was an interesting detail. Yeah. I think it was possibly their first marriage in each case as well. You know, may as well try it now. Anyway.
A very handsome couple.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
anyway.
So, yeah. So the story... You see, all Eric Sykes' stories... I don't believe any of them. They just don't ring quite true. But Eric Sykes' story is that after the war, he, Sykes, was trying to make it in showbiz or something, and he was living in terrible conditions in London. And Bill Fraser, who'd been more sort of maybe officer class in the war and been in this concert party thing with him, came along and found him and took great pity on him. You know, he's like starving in his garret in the winter of 1947, the winter of the terrible snows and everything. Sykes says that Fraser employed him as a writer for the next few weeks and paid him £5 a week. And he never had to write a thing. Sykes never had to write anything for him. He was just being nice and helping him out. Yeah, I don't believe it. Maybe he was. Maybe what was Bill Fraser doing there to make money at the start? But no, the next thing is that Sykes becomes Frankie Howard's writer. This is why Sykes was the biggest writer at the time, because Frankie Howard was this huge, hugely successful comedian. But in keeping with this theme of, you know, there was no kind of proper ecosystem for all these writers and everything, he couldn't find a decent writer. And he was Frankie Howard at the time, so 1947, he was the resident compere on Variety Bandbox. And one week it would be him, and who was it the other week, Tyler? A name familiar to Goonpod fans? The other week it was Derek Roy. Why do we know Derek Roy? Because Spike spoke so highly of him.
Spike once described Derek Roy as about as funny as a baby with cancer.
That's right. That's one of those Spike lines that I do not like so much.
No.
It's sort of off, isn't it?
Spike wrote for him in the early days.
That's right, yes. And so it's funny, isn't it? So Eric starts off as Frankie Howard's writer, and Spike starts off as Derek Roy's writer. But Derek Roy, I mean, so obviously, you know, Frankie sort of carried on for years, didn't he? Although it did also always seem like his career was dying off, because that's
he had renaissances.
Yeah,
is that such a word? Renaissances? I don't know.
That is the thing, you know, that Galton and Simpson told me when I went to speak to them for my Associated London Scripts program. That when Hancock gave them the old heave ho in 1961, he got rid of Galton and Simpson as writers, and so they went to the BBC and. Whoever it was there, Tom Sloan or whoever the guy was that they went to, said, okay, what do you want to do now? If you're not writing for Hancock anymore. And they said, we want to do something for Frankie Howard. This is 1961. And the BBC official told them, no, he's finished. Frankie Howard, no, he's had it. Forget him. Mm. And of course, no, he just kept coming back. But Derek Roy... I suppose it's like, you know, this could have happened to Frankie and Derek Roy just faded away.
Derek Roy is a footnote in British comedy. Not even that. A footnote, maybe.
Derek Roy was not invited to join ALS. Frankie Howard can't find a writer, but he remembers, back in the war, I saw this review with them. It must have been with Bill Fraser and Dennis Norden and Eric Sykes. And Eric Sykes used to go on stage under the name Rick Allen in those days. So Frankie thought, oh, that Rick Allen character is very good. So he seeks Sykes out and he finds him. and he employs him as his writer. And here's another detail in Eric Sykes's, I think this is all from Eric Sykes's autobiography. I do not believe any of it. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's just me being cynical. But Sykes says the act that Frankie Howard had seen him doing during the war, he hadn't written it at all. He just nicked it off, you know, routines off, you know, American Forces Network or something, some American comedians. And he just cobbled this routine together. But Frankie employs him as a writer, and it turns out quite fortunate, because, you know, Eric Sykes then turns out to be, you know, he hadn't written this act during the war, but then he turns out to be this brilliant comedy writer. And he, of course, the first thing he does for him is this routine about the elephants.
I went along to the depot and I saw the foreman. I said, "Look, I said, I've got these. I'll sign for these goods. They're saying it's a good." He said, "They're labelled and ready. Get them out of here quick." So I signed for them. So I went along. They were labelled and ready, all right. Two elephants. Two elephants. I was the man. I said, "Yeah." I said, "I shall never get these to crew." I said, "I shall never get these to crew." He said, "I don't care where you get them to, but get them out of here." He said, "The place has been in uproar. In uproar, the place has been." So I got a bit of string. And I tied it around their necks, you see. And I led them out into the street. Oh, I didn't feel a ninny. I tried to look as though I wasn't with them. Anyway, but the way people stared, the way people stared, you'd think they'd never seen two elephants going down the underground before.
So Sykes is writing Variety Bandbox. Frankie Howard moves on from there, but Sykes is still his writer. But then Sykes starts doing an even, you know, the most popular show on radio from 1950. And what was that called?
Educating Archie.
He was Educating Archie. And who did he write it with? Sid Collin. Our friend Sid Collin. He was a Django Reinhardt star guitar player. Did you know that, Sid Collin? He'd been in Sid Millward and the Nitwits before the war.
Of course he was.
Anyway, okay. So Sykes starts doing that. So he'd got the link with Peter Brough and Educating Archie. That was from Variety Bandbox. The people they had on Educating Archie. It was start off with Max Bygraves and Julie Andrews, Benny Hill, Harry Secombe, Dick Emery, James Robertson Justice. They all first crop up on Educating Archie. It's incredible. Yeah. It was Beryl Reed that drove Eric Sykes off Educating Archie because she wanted more jokes. So that was the end for Eric. He gave up writing it. But also, Educating Archie had its own regular harmonica player. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Do you not know who it was?
It wasn't Max.
It wasn't Max. It was Ronald Chesney. And Ronald
as
Wolfe.
In...
Yeah, so Ronald Wolfe was also in the cast. So Educating Archie, you know, thanks to that, we got on the buses. And speaking of Blakey.
Thanks for that.
Back round to Blakey. And, of course, Meet the Wife, as featured in Good Morning, Good Morning.
Good Morning, Good Morning.
Anyway, I now turn to Andre Vincent's Mislaid Comedy Heroes website for this next little bit of the story, because after the first series of this is why this is important to our story. After the end of the first series of Educating Archie, Sykes began to complain of ear pain and general hearing problems. So that's the very end of 1950. And Peter Brough, who's the ventriloquist, the ventriloquist whose lips move, told Sykes to... Actually, I suppose Sykes would still be able to lip read, wouldn't he, with Peter Brough, even when he went deaf. But Peter Brough told him to go and see a doctor. But Sykes ignored this advice because he had a pressing theatre commitment in Swansea that night. This is all from Andre Vincent's excellent website. While packing for the trip, he, Sykes, was interrupted by a knock at the door, and Brough's chauffeur had arrived to take Sykes straight round to Harley Street to be checked up. And in fact, he had an infected mastoid. So he says, if it hadn't been for Peter Brough's action, he would have been dead within 3 days.
What?
Yeah, how about that?
Hang on, sorry. So an affected, what did you say, mastoid?
Mastoid, yeah.
Is that in the ear then?
It's something to do with the ear, and this is why he went deaf.
How can an ear infection kill you?
I don't know. If it got into the brain or something, I suppose. I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
So if it wasn't for Peter Brough, we wouldn't have Associated London Scripts.
Well, that's
arguably.
Right. Eric Sykes, you know, he would have been and gone.
And British comedy, the future mm-hmm. British comedy, because yeah. obviously the echoes, the tremors, if you like, of Associated London Scripts, we can still feel today.
Yeah.
You could say that Brough,
yep.
Peter Brough,
yep.
helped make British comedy what it is and what it became.
Absolutely. Do not say a bad word against that man. Yeah. It's just another little detail, which I... this must be off Andre Vincent's website as well. It says, following them... Sorry. Following the manufacture of a new head for Archie, the show, Educating Archie, took a sabbatical between February and May 1953 to give Brough some time to adjust to the dummy's working tongue. Honestly, this is just... Right.
What are you up to at the moment, Brough? I'm just trying to adapt to Archie's new tongue.
Anyway, the reason all this is important, Eric Sykes and his ear surgery,
yeah.
is because it is just after that Eric starts at 130 Uxbridge Road, above the greengrocers. So it's just after his first ear operation. And it's in February 1951 that Sykes and Frankie Howard buy the lease on these offices, right? And they do this at the behest of their agent, Scruffy Dale, this man Stanley Dale. So they all set up a company, or in fact they set up several companies. They set up Frankie Howard Limited, Frankie Howard Scripts Limited, and Eric Sykes Limited. So he seems quite on the ball business-wise, Scruffy Dale. Yeah, so Milligan comes into this greengrocers thing with all the offices, all the empty offices, and only Sykes is there. So Milligan suggests, oh, we'll have a writer's commune.
This is where we get to the point where they agree that they're going to set up this, this like you say, this commune, this collective. And originally they wanted to call it, I believe, Associated British Scripts.
That's right.
But they weren't allowed, so they settled on London.
Yeah.
And Associated, calling it Associated London Scripts meant it would turn up early on in the phone book as well.
It was in Spike's mind that it should have been a workers' cooperative. I don't think it was anybody else's mind. I just think the rest of the guys were just saying, well, look, we'll all bung in 10% and just sort of make the office work.
And there's that thing in the interview I did with John Entrevist where the first thing I ask him, why did they start this thing? And he says that it's because they're all very lonely. There probably is something in that.
Yeah.
It's
I know that things weren't great in the Milligan marriage.
No.
And the implication was that he would look for excuses to be out of the house.
Yeah.
So he didn't like writing at home.
Yeah. Mm. Around this time it's a little bit earlier, isn't it, when he tries to kill Peter Sellers with the potato knife.
Well, yeah, that's
series 3.
18 months.
Series 3.
18 months, yeah.
He was going to peel Peter Sellers to death. Mrs. Sellers would come home and find the horrifying sight of a long, long strip of Peter Sellers all curled up around the hallway. So really, I mean, it all sort of points to, you know, with Michael Bentine going and then that incident with Peter Sellers and then Larry, you know, and Spike is in the hospital in Muswell Hill, isn't he? And Larry keeps the show going, doesn't he? And keeps Spike's name in the credits, which is very good of him.
Jimmy Grafton as well.
Jimmy Grafton, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
Which is interesting. That okay, I know that Jimmy Grafton more or less became an agent.
Yeah,
didn't he? But he was never involved or asked to be involved with ALS. As far as I know.
No, that's true, isn't it? I mean, I do wonder, maybe we've talked about this before when I've been on, but what were Spike's feelings about Jimmy Grafton? Obviously, Harry stayed with him. There's that story that John Cleese told about Jimmy Grafton and Harry Secombe. Do you remember that? That it was John Cleese working with Harry Secombe somewhere, and he saw Or I don't know, he's just in a dressing room with Harry Secombe, and Jimmy Grafton came and presented him with the script, and Harry didn't think it was terribly funny, and Jimmy just wouldn't do anything with it. Well, just leave that up to you. You'll sort that out, won't you? And John Cleese didn't think this was very impressive, you know, that because Jimmy Grafton, as well as being Harry's agent, was his writer. So that just sort of kept him in business for years, writing the Harry Secombe show on the telly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, so Spike and Larry have sort of split up. So Larry stays in the office, presumably with Kavanagh's in Shaftesbury Avenue. Because I think they were both at Kavanagh's, both Spike and Larry, because Spike leaves... I've got a note somewhere that Spike leaves Kavanagh's around this time in 1954. Mm-hmm. And he starts working at the Greengrocer's, where Eric Sykes has an office.
Let's talk about how Ray and Alan get involved.
Yeah, because let's talk about Ray and Alan. So, as you know, they've been in the TB sanatorium. They were too young for World War II. They were too young for World War I as well, by an even greater margin. So they join Associated London Scripts on the 1st of September 1954. So I suppose they're invited in. So it's not just Eric and Spike sitting there. Suddenly they've got a whole proper thing. And there's, you know, the importance is previously, I think they'd just been sitting at home at Alan Simpson's mum's house writing their scripts. So they are just, what, 24 and 26 this time, I think, Ray and Alan. So very young. And September 1954, so that is when Series 5 of The Goon Show kicks off, and you've got Whistling Spy Enigma and Dreaded Better Pudding Hurler and
Phantom Head Shaver.
That's right, yes. So Hancock's Half Hour, which Galton Simpson famously write, hadn't even started. It starts in November, I think, that year. So
it airs the same night as the Goon Show episode, The Canal.
Right.
Which I think, from memory, was the last episode of Series 5 that Spike wrote on his own before Eric joined up.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they come in. They'd only just managed to get their hands on the telephone, Galton and Simpson. You know, it was all very well for Eric Sykes getting his phone from the BBC. So they join up. Yeah, so they'd been in this TV sanatorium. They'd started writing scripts there because they did a sort of little, you know, hospital radio sort of thing there to amuse the other patients. That was the thing when we did these interviews with Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, which was you know, that was such a thrill to go and meet Ray and Alan, and they were absolutely and Ray had the loveliest house that you've ever seen, and I think it was over near Hampton Court. It may have been Hampton Court actually, but it was a lovely fire in the grate there. This is like in the on a winter's day, and lovely and cozy, and it is Christmas tree and everything, and fire in the grate, and it's just a beautiful house. Mm. And he was saying he'd been in this TB sanatorium. So when did we speak to him? So it was about 2004, 20 years ago. He'd been in this TB sanatorium, so what would that be, 56 years earlier? Mm. And great holes in his lungs, they said. You know, he was given like 8 weeks or something to live, you know, really, something like that. You know, you are going to die if we don't sort this. And there was no kind of, you know, the what's hadn't come in yet, the antibiotics or something to clear this up.
Penicillin,
yeah, whatever. So he's telling us this, you know, he'd just been given weeks or, you know, a few months to live or something, whilst rolling himself a cigarette in 2004. I mean, you think, oh, is this the best idea? Anyway, he had a great long life, and more power to him. So they've been writing on all these sort of things. Frankie Howard, they've written for Derek Roy, I think. Yeah, because they did Happy Go Lucky, didn't they? Isn't that right? So which was the one that Spike wrote for with Derek Roy?
Hip 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 Hooray.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So I think the titles show you.
Yeah.
So they write for this thing, Happy Go Lucky. I think somebody else, was it like Monkhouse and Goodwin, who was writing it before them? And and it was all a bit of a disaster, this series. There was lots of rows going on. But they got some material into one episode of this, and The producer was Roy Spear, and then he must have had enough. So he went. So Dennis Mayne Wilson came in towards the end of this series, Happy Go Lucky, with Derek Roy. And Dennis Mayne Wilson invited Ray. Dennis Mayne Wilson is responsible for a lot, isn't he? Blimey. So he asked Ray and Alan to come in and write the last three shows in this, you know, disaster of a series. So they bought a typewriter with their first paycheck. Also in that show, I think, was Tony Hancock, Bill Kerr, Graham Stark and Peter Butterworth. So they wrote a sketch for Tony Hancock called The Eager Beavers. I think this was all in the same series. And Hancock was very impressed with, you know, the sketch they'd written for him. So that's how all that started.
So we've got the main four, five, if you want to include Frankie, I suppose.
Yeah.
Frankie obviously wasn't a writer, but...
No.
But then you've got this. Have you got what would you call it? The second wave that come in, like Johnny Spate.
The other thing, just before we go on to that, I was just going to say the basis on which they do this, because we talk about it being a writers' cooperative, but in fact, what they do is they all put in their 10% of their earnings into the business, and some sources say they put in 90% and then took 10% as their wages. How would that work? So it's not a cooperative, because they don't put in all their money and then they just share it all between them. Because the issue there with this 10% is what comes up with Sellers when they try and get Sellers to join. So he nearly joins, but he won't come in because his agent says his 10% will be more than everyone else's 10%. I see.
Yeah.
Sellers said he would join Associated London Scripts if everyone else put in £5,000. So, you know, not just 10%. You've got to pay. Maybe that is Sellers' 10%. I don't know at the time. No. Could it be? He's on £50,000 a year or something.
He wouldn't have been. Surely not in the mid-50s, no.
But that's what he... I don't know, you see. Where did I get this from? I don't know if this is from Graham McKenna's book as well. But anyway, Sellers said he'd join if everyone else put in £5,000. But Galton Simpson obviously can't afford to do that. So this is true. Whatever the figures exactly were, maybe it'll turn out that it wasn't quite there. But Galton Simpson weren't earning as much as any of the others at the time. Milligan sticks up for Galton and Simpson and says, you know, they can't, you know, these lads can't afford to pay the same as Sellers. And it's unfair to, you know, maybe he was talking about himself, I wondered. It's unfair to make me pay £5,000. I mean, that would make sense with, you know, his troubles with the first Mrs. Milligan and her spending habits, wouldn't it?
We used to have writers' conferences when we moved to High Street, Ken, and this was where we would all get together in a democratic fashion, because the directors, they paid their 10% as well as the clients, but they didn't pay any rent for their offices, and we did. And Johnny Spate brought this up, and Spike Milligan just left and slammed the door. We never saw him at a writers' conference again. And he said, well, that's the end of a cooperative as far as I'm concerned. It'd have nothing more to do with it.
So, yes, they bring in these other writers. So the next two through the door are John Antrobus, well, Johnny Spate first. And I think Johnny Spate had been... he'd been doing some work for Frankie Howard or something, hadn't he? So Frankie Howard was always on the look for more material.
Yeah. Johnny Spate's an interesting guy. I don't know. I've heard him interviewed a few times, and obviously I know his work, but he's an interesting one. And John Antrobus, because Mike sent me the unedited recording that he made when he interviewed John Antrobus all those years ago, which is very interesting. And at one point John Antrobus describes Johnny Spate as a Stalinist.
Yeah, probably was. Yeah.
And
Stalin had just died, Eddie. It was 1954. Is that 53? Right. So again, the death of Stalin, it all fits in.
But obviously, I know that Alf Garner is not based on Spate's own views. Of course,
no,
quite the opposite. But I've just got this image in my head of Johnny Spate, because again, John Antrobus mentions that he often would go to the pub with Eric Sykes. Eric Sykes was no Stalinist.
No, no. Well, that's what he says, that Eric was the token Tory in the Associated London Scripts. And Spike was just an anarchist or something. Ray and Alan would be more lefty, and Johnny Spate was somewhere far to the left of them.
And why did he? Because he was interviewed. He met Ray and Alan to discuss coming on board or joining ALS. Mm. And what was the reason he thought they were gay?
Oh no, I think because they were finely dressed. Ray was a bit of a dandy. Ray particularly was a bit of a dandy, and I don't know. Johnny Spate sort of just was very suspicious of everybody working in show business because he thought they were all gay. You know,
he was impressed when Ray told him how much his suit cost.
Right. Yes.
And he looked forward. Spate looked forward to the day when he could buy one equally as and reassuringly expensive.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they came along, but I suppose that was after Beryl Virtue, who I think she was an old friend of Alan's. Alan Simpson had been at primary school, I think, with Beryl and her future husband, Clem. And I might have played football with Clem as well or something. And so they'd had a typist, hadn't they, when they started? So September 54, yes. They get going. They have some other, and she turned out not to be very good. So, so Beryl had been typing up scripts for Ray and Ellen anyway, because she'd just done a course at Secretarial College or something. She'd also had TB and just sort of come out as, so they're looking around for someone else. So I think Alan persuades her to come in for an interview. So she goes in, and of course, Spike does a wacky interview with her and asks her lots of questions about tea. So she talks about that in the programme, what sort of tea do you like and how do you make your tea and everything. And I think she'd be perfect. And she didn't want the job at all because it was just too far out of her way, because she was somewhere in South London somewhere, and this was over in Shepherd's Bush. So it involved, getting a trolley bus, and it was all just farty. She was very good, Beryl. She was absolutely great. She came along to the interview in her little suit and everything, and she was just really good. And of course, she goes on to have as great a career, you could say, as any of them. It's just absolutely amazing. She starts off as the typist, and they have to persuade her to come in because she doesn't want the job. She tries to price herself out of it. She tells them, well, I'll do it if you pay me, whatever it is, £10 a week, some extraordinary figure. And so they're all horrified by that. So she's almost got out of it. But then somebody says, oh, well, that's only £2.50 each, isn't it? Or, £2.10 in those days. And so she gets the job. And and really, it becomes her story.
One of the things, the reason that they'd formed this company was to encourage other people and to help other people. So I think the BBC thought this was a bit of a godsend, because when people wanted to write, they wrote to the BBC. And so they used to say, there's some writers down in Shepherd's Bush, why don't you go down there? So different writers began to arrive who were sort of new on the scene. When I look back, I think how extraordinary my life has become, because I said, oh, all right then.
She is just the typist, but then they start asking her after a while, could you, speak to the... Because it's very difficult for... This is why you have an agent. This is why I've never got anywhere. If you have an agent, they can just get you a bit more money. It's just easier for somebody else to ask for a bit more money for you. And so she has to speak to the BBC on Colton Simpson's behalf and says, well, there's two of them and, they work very hard and, it's not fair that, they're just having to split this same fee. So, there would have been like half each of what maybe Spike was getting. So she gets them a bit more. And and then she starts doing this for all the writers, getting them a little bit more and the contracts. And eventually, somebody says, how long have you been an agent for? And she didn't realise she was an agent. She becomes the manager of this thing, and she becomes an agent. And, of course, the really famous one, of course, down the line, one of the writers who comes through the door is a guy called Terry Nation. And Terry Nation invents the Daleks in Doctor Who. He didn't invent Doctor Who, but he did invent the Daleks.
Well, yeah, and Beryl she came up with the idea of merchandising.
Yeah, well, yes. That's right.
The product. So, like you say, with the Daleks, things like Telegoons, glove puppets.
Yes.
There was a Hancock board game.
There was a Hancock board game, and I mentioned that to her, and she'd completely forgotten that. might have been the first thing that they did like that, a sort of spin-off product. There must have been something in the contract about, you know, associated products or whatever. Well, you're never going to have that, so she just crosses it out, and nobody noticed, you know. But then that just turns out to be hugely lucrative, especially for somebody like Terry Nation. But then the other thing that she did do was the bit she may have crossed out in the contract was about the overseas rights or whatever it was, which meant that they could then sell the format. And of course, that turned out to be huge. Because then, you know, she was able to sort of pioneer this idea that, okay, you've got Till Death Us Do Part that Johnny Spate comes up with and becomes a huge hit in the 60s, but then they could sell the format of that to America. So they kept hold of the format. It wasn't handed on to the BBC. Associated London Scripts kept the format, and then you could sell it to and have it turned into All in the Family with Archie Bunker.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves, because we haven't really... we mentioned Johnny Spate. We mentioned John Antrobus in passing, I suppose. But John was ex-Sandhurst.
Yes.
And by his own admission, he was quite posh. And he was the youngest as well.
That's right. And then he came in and he learned from Johnny Spate to speak like a bit of a Cockney, which he's still doing to this day. I mean, the story, again, it's worth digging out from that interview that he... was he renting a room from Bill Kerr's... mother-in-law. Oh yeah, so Bill Kerr was married to an English woman, and his mother-in-law. So he got in touch then, and they got him to write a kind of, you know, trial Hancock script, which obviously, I mean, I wonder if he's still got that. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? And that got him in. So he's 21. So he's very, you know, he's 21, and now he's...
Didn't he do this? He said he did the same thing later with the Army Game. He wrote. He asked Peter Eaton, the producer, if he could write for the Army Game, and Peter Eaton knocked him back.
Really?
And then he just wrote a script and sent it in anyway to Peter Eaton.
Yeah.
And Peter Eaton got in contact straight away and said, love it. Do you want to do some more?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, he had this relationship with Spike. I don't mean that sort of relationship, listeners. I mean a working relationship. Not that there's anything wrong with that sort of thing. But I do wonder, you know, like, obviously the bed-sitting room is, like, the biggest thing he ever did, but you do wonder, like, did Spike sort of take that over quite a bit? And the original idea that, you know, Antrobus describes, you know, is this guy... What was it? The guy who's turning into a bed-sitting room.
Mm.
And his analyst or his psychiatrist or something is living in the bed-sitting room. So if he cures him, then he'll be homeless, you know. It's something like that. That's the original idea. But then Spike adds all the Spikeness to it. And I suppose it's slightly, you know, the bed sitting room overshadows everything else, because that was such a success in the early 60s, and Milligan is involved in this. So if he's doing something then not with Milligan, people, where's Spike sort of thing? You get that. But also probably his issues that cropped up afterwards, and he came and, you know, had a bit of trouble with the bottle, I believe.
He's very open about that, and he talks about how he... A bit like Dick Van Dyke in the late 60s, he lost entire years. There's entire years that he doesn't remember. And John Antrobus implies that that was similar with him, in terms of he doesn't remember what happened after the sort of Stigwood period kicked in.
In this office we had, it was all laughter and phones and typewriters and things banging away. Some people wrote by hand. It was all... quite odd, and I had a blackboard.
There was a big blackboard. It was rather like a bomber command control room, and chalked on this board were the names of the writers with their current employment, and Beryl would sort of rub out this or put this one in. I thought the board was was fatuous. What's he going to say? Like, Johnny Spate is now approaching Limegrove Studios. Come in, Johnny Spate. And Galton and Simpson at Elstree, you know, on Hancock, latest Hancock film. You know, I mean, it's just useless information. And sending Pam to rub things out and chalk new things up.
They move around, don't they? They start off in that greengrocer's at Uxbridge Road. Then they move from there in 1957. So I suppose in the immediate wake of, you know, starting up 1954, 1955, Johnny Spate of Pair of Virtue starts on 1st of January 1955, I think. And then Johnny Spate and John Entrebus come in, I think, during the course of that year. And then you get the other people. Eventually, they're so big that they move to another place in Kensington High Street in 1957, larger premises. Then they sell the Kensington offices and they buy perhaps the most famous address to us, which is Orme Court, 9 Orme Court in Bayswater Road, which is absolutely lovely. So there was a
which is now the Kosovo embassy.
Truly,
hmm.
Is it?
As of last year.
Oh
yes.
My good. So where have Kosovo got the money from? Is this all sort of dodgy money? Because it was up for sale the year before, $6.5 million.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And, yeah, there's a piece in the Daily Mail about it. And I was thinking, you know, this can't be right, because they're saying, you know, the Goon Show was rehearsed here. Well, not if they went in 1960.
No.
But then I thought, well, yeah, but then I thought what they mean is the last Goon Show of all. So, yeah, they would have gone in there and gone through it, probably. And he says the Daleks were created here and Davros. Davros is 70s, but no, apparently Terry Nation went back in 1975 to sit in there and, unless the Daily Mail just added that detail, to write, you know, whatever it is, Genesis of the Daleks.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about Terry Nation?
Yes. Terry Nation turns up with a guy called Dick Barry, or I don't know, maybe they were both from Wales. So I think they may have turned up as, you know, two for the price of one sort of thing together. Mm. But yeah, so Terry Nation is one of the writers. So yeah, we should actually just mention the other people who come through the door. Johnny Spate, John Entrebus, Dick Barry, Terry Nation. John Junkin turns up. He's written a Goon Show script and he gets the number for ALS and he comes in and finds Milligan there on a Saturday morning. And so he gets in and shows him this Goon Show script. Who else you've got? Dave Freeman. Brad Ashton, Dick Vosborough, Maurice Wiltshire, Lou Schwartz, Eric Merriman, Barry Took eventually.
Marty Feldman,
yeah. Yeah. But yeah, Terry Nation. So he is one of ALS's writers. It's interesting in, you know, relation to Galton and Simpson, because Galton and Simpson get the push from Hancock in November 1961. So this is just after they've done that amazing series where they've got done the Blood Donor and the Radio Ham and all these kind of, you know, the I think the Lift is in that series as well, isn't it? The Bowmans. So they've just done all that, and then they've tried to write another screenplay for him, another film, and then he gets fed up with it, and it's just, you know, it's very foolish behavior. He just sacks them as his writer. By that stage, obviously Beryl is acting as Hancock's manager as well, so he's sort of must have come in by that stage, but so Hancock.
But, then,
know,
he give Beryl the elbow as well, because
his brother
Roger becomes his agent.
That's right, yeah. So, and I think that meeting lasts about, you know, a minute or something. He just sacks them all. You know, I just don't want you to write for me anymore. Although it always seemed, you know, when I spoke to Galton and Simpson, there was a slight bit of, you know, did he mean I don't want you to write for me ever again, or I don't want you to carry on writing these, you know, try out film scripts for me. But anyway, what it came to was that they went off and they tried to pitch their series with Frankie Howard, and Tom Sloan or whoever it was at the BBC said, no, you can't do Frankie Howard because he's finished. So he had this other thing for them, which was Comedy Playhouse, and he didn't know what it was. It's just got a title called Comedy Playhouse, and you can do whatever you want. You can be in it, you can write it, you can do whatever, you can direct it, produce it, whatever. And so they do, you know, it becomes, you know, like a series of one-off half hours. And the fourth one you know, they're stuck for an idea. So they start writing this idea and they come up with the thing of the two Rag and Bone Men.
The offer,
yeah. Which turns into a series, listeners. It becomes very popular. It's Steptoe and Son. And then Beryl sells it to America as Sanford and Son. But Terry,
although Mike, you say that, yes, of course, it is the American version.
Yeah,
that we know is Sanford and Son, but did you know there was an earlier?
Oh, was there? Yeah,
American was a pilot in the 60s, and it was called Steptoe and Son, and I have seen it.
Who was in that?
I can't remember. Anyway,
it was very different. So they sold them the format, and then the Americans changed it greatly. Where were we? Terry Nation, right? So. Gold and Simpson have been given the push from Hancock, but then Hancock, a year or so later, is touring round, and this is before, you know, Doctor Who and everything, and his writer that he's touring round the, you know, treading the boards, and the guy is going around with him, is Terry Nation. So this is odd, isn't it? Because he's sacked Beryl, he's sacked Galton and Simpson, but now he's using somebody from, you know, down the corridor, Terry Nation, to be, you know, his writer, another ALS writer. That just seems peculiar to me, that having done anything as drastic and terrible as he had done, and ultimately suicidal, literally suicidal, in getting rid of Galton Simpson, that he's then using Terry Nation.
I didn't offend anybody, did I, when I was all right?
Oh, you were simply marvellous. All the chums were falling about.
Were they, huh? I can't remember, but I do know I can be a bit of a wag when I'm on the milk stout. Did I sing I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen?
Yes, several times.
Yes. But I didn't offend anybody.
No, not at all. Now look, why don't you go and get dressed? I'll wake up Sarah.
Sarah?
Yes, Sarah. Yes. And then we'll all go and have a spot of breakfast together. Hmm?
Yes, that's a good idea. I didn't actually punch anybody.
No, you were frightfully nice.
Terry Nation is going around these theatres with Hancock, and one day they are shooting the breeze, and Hancock comes up with this idea of these pepper pot shaped robots, and we start sketching them out and everything. And so a year or so after that, Hancock is watching the telly, Doctor Who comes on, and lo and behold, who is, you know, who's written this series on Doctor Who but Terry Nation, and there's the Daleks. And Hancock is basically, you know, stole me. Terry Nation has stolen my robots.
Imagine if he'd got that Dalek dollar, he'd have been in clover for the rest of his life, wouldn't he, Hancock?
Yeah, well, maybe he just wasn't bothered. Yeah, the thing about Terry Nation, and he kept control of the Daleks, which then meant, because Beryl Virtue's daughter is Sue Virtue, and she got married to Stephen Moffat.
Moffat,
who then becomes the showrunner in a later incarnation of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So then when he wants to get the Daleks on Doctor Who, he's not got to negotiate with his, you know, the estate of Terry Nation or something, because they retained the rights to the Daleks. So, you know, there's a payout to the heirs of Terry Nation.
Isn't it crazy? You think, you know, 1959, 1960, in the offices of ALS, and you've got Beryl Virtue and Terry Nation, you know. Mm. Little did they know that...
this will be a dynasty.
What, 40, 50 years later? Yeah.
It's more than 60-odd years later, and this is still a thing, yeah. So,
John Antrobus talks about, you know, they everyone shared around assignments depending on their workload, even if it was a lucrative gig. You know, it was quite egalitarian in that sense, and there was a lot of wandering in and out of others' offices, for inspiration or just a smoke and a drink.
Yeah,
they played golf in Terry Nation's office and darts in Lou Schwartz's office. They'd go to the pub, the Moscow Arms, which was nearby, a lot.
As soon as we had finished a day's work, probably Spate and anyone else that was around, we'd go straight up into Eric's room. And he wasn't there. He was either playing golf or doing something or other. Open up his cocktail cabinet and get stuck in. And Eric would appear and we'd say, oh, the pubs are open, let's go down to Moscow Arms. Chucking out time there or near enough, we'd say, where should we go next? That was the BBC club then at Television Centre, which was the best bar in London, and apart from Eric's place. So we'd all pile down there. I don't know how we got any work done, really, but it was a very productive time.
It's called youth. Guy and I, were at that time, were doing 40 scripts a year. God knows how.
I think we'd better go back to it, don't you?
Of course, the other thing which is important for Goonpod listeners is the guy who runs the junk shop, who is William, isn't he? He's actually... Oh. So that's where he comes from, because he had the junk shop next to Associated London Scripts. Yeah. That's where... can that be correct? Anyway.
John mentions someone tries to join ALS and keeps coming in with scripts, but they keep rejecting him. And he says he's dressed as a Boy Scout.
Yes, he does.
And I'm wondering, is he thinking of Ruxton Hayward?
Yeah, maybe he is. Maybe that is the link.
But he described rather loftily, John described the overall mindset of the ALS group as Chekhovian.
What did he mean by that, do you think?
I don't quite know. But no, it seemed like they would all sort of bounce ideas off each other. Yeah. It was an open, very much an open door policy in every office.
I suppose that is another important reason why they would have all these extra writers, because the thing is, if you are a successful writer, not that I would ever know anything about that, but then you're getting so much work that you can't do it all yourself. But if you've got somebody up the corridor, you know, oh, I know this, we've got John Entrepus just up the corridor. And if you can't get Spike Milligan, John Entrepus will do, something is good sort of thing. So that is one reason for having all these extra people in. You can spread all that work. You don't have to turn any work away. So also, it becomes like, the BBC writers' room sort of thing, doesn't it?
This is
where BBC don't know what to do with all these people who are turning up, so they send them there. So, maybe that is where Ruxton Hayward went.
What sparked the ashtray incident?
With Eric Sykes? Spike was a difficult person to actually sit... it's just the stress they must be under. So Larry has sort of hit the bottle and gone. And this was the final straw for, Eric came in and started trying to fight the goon. So how many actual goon shows did he sit and actually write with Spike in the room with him before they started?
Well, there's the thing. I don't think we really know. There's a handful of the nearly 20, maybe, the 20 goon shows in Series 5 that are joint credited to Spike and Eric.
Yeah.
Maybe a third, maybe half, were probably mostly written by Eric, and the others were mostly written by Spike, with some where there was maybe a bit more collaboration, I think.
So they might have lasted about 6 weeks actually sitting in the same room together trying to do it.
Yeah, maybe.
And then
maybe.
we have the ashtray incident. I mean, the thing I always think with that is, what happened to the person who's walking on the pavement outside when the ashtray came down? You don't hear about them, do you? But that could have been lethal, that ashtray coming down. They were just arguing over a line, weren't they? They just couldn't quite get the rhythm of a... Isn't that what he said? It was just, just one word in a line. Should it be this or should it be that or whatever? And Spike throws the ashtray at him and he ducks. The ashtray goes through the window, lands on some unfortunate soul walking down Uxbridge Road, just going to go in and buy his pan of potatoes at the greengrocer's. It can't have been a glass ashtray, can it? It must have been metal, because Sykes goes down and picks it up and brings it back up, puts it back on the table. What does he say? Don't forget which day this was or something. Isn't that what he says to him?
Something like that.
And so from then on, of course, they were very practical, Eric Sykes, because, they remained the best of friends. And then...
Spike was very dismissive of Larry's talents. He was kind of grudgingly complimentary about Eric's contribution to the game show. It's quite interesting that he was quite comfortable working with John Entrebus as well. I think it's because John Entrebus probably was just so laid back and quite gentle.
And younger.
And obviously younger,
and also less successful. Eric was younger.
True.
And much more successful when they started this.
True.
Maybe that is an issue. I don't know if it is, but I'm just reading into it. That it's like, you know, Eric in a way is the senior partner. And then the Spike, and then he brings in Galton and Simpson. So there's somebody below, you know, in the hierarchy who's below Spike. You know. Well, that is conjecture. That is absolute conjecture. But yeah, he doesn't have that, you know, he's able to sit in a room and work with people like John Entrobus, and he's able to sit in a room and work with obviously Neil Shand for years.
Yeah.
But then you notice, you know, like John was saying in that interview in later life, you know, he just becomes, you know, there's just always an insult coming from Spike. And you just have to not take it personally, sort of thing.
I always longed to be a playwright. While I was scriptwriting, I still longed to be a playwright. And although I enjoyed scriptwriting and I was a natural at it, and Spike asked me to write goon shows with him, but I only wrote two with him. But I mean, that was a great experience and a wonderful things. I went along to the first read through, and Spike said, because Peter Sellers was the only one wearing a suit, and Spike said, we haven't got much money, the goons, he says, but we decided to save up for a suit, and we've given it to Peter Sellers to wear for the first 3 years. But if Peter Sellers kept wearing it, they never bought a second suit.
The other person I was going to just say a bit about, if we have time, was Scruffy Dale, because his name lives on with one of his clients, Jim Dale. Jim Dale was given his name by Scruffy Dale.
I'm trying to think of some celebrity called Scruffy.
Also, Scruffy Dale, he managed the Vipers Skiffle Group through ALS.
Right.
And they were recording where else? Parlophone, George Martin producing. Scruffy Dale sets up this tour, the Hunt for the Country's Best Skiffle Act. So, there's two proper acts on the bill, Jim Dale and the Vipers. So they go around the country doing these shows, and it's like Britain's Got Talent sort of thing, Britain's Got Skiffle, and all the local skiffle groups go on. And this was a terrible idea because they've all got exactly the same repertoire. So you can watch the Vipers doing all these kind of songs properly. Because, you know, what have you got? You've got Rock Island Line and Don't You Rock Me Daddy-O or something, you know. Not many. So all these, little Spotty Herberts sort of come up and do those skiffle things as the kind of talent show bit, and they'll do the same songs as the Vipers then come on and do properly at the end. So it's a terrible talent show. Anyway, so interesting enough, the Scruffy Dale skiffle talent show comes to Liverpool in March 1958. So who do you think was in that? No, it wasn't. It was the Raving Texans. The Raving Texans. You can then get excited again because, they eventually become Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Oh, do you mean Ringo was the drummer? No, he wasn't. They didn't have Ringo until a little bit later, I don't think. And they didn't win. It was the Darktown Skiffle Group, the winners in Liverpool.
Right.
Actually, I'm wondering if this all has all come from another excellent guest on your podcast, Andrew Hickey. But Spike Milligan never liked Scruffy Dale. Eric Sykes and Frankie Howard thought he was good at contracts. He then took on Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. So what he was doing is some sort of dodgy accounting thing that was going on with Scruffy Dale. So he's siphoning money away from Sykes and Frankie Howard. And if he had a success with his music acts, he would count that as something he'd done independently, so he would get the money. But if he was unsuccessful, strangely enough, it was then marked down as an ALS project, so they had to carry the bill for it. So this will have upset Milligan, won't it?
Yeah.
So they have this running, and it's all successful, and they're all doing their programs, and it's going from strength to strength, and you've got Steptoe and Son, and Spike's doing his stuff, and Eric Sykes, of course, has his TV series, which runs all through the 60s and 70s.
Sykes and then Sykes, yeah.
Yes, yeah, originally written by Johnny Spaid. Until Death Us Do Part starts 1965. I mean, John Antrimus is, you know, he says that Johnny Spaid was working on that from the word go.
And was it called Jamaica Road or something?
Yeah, he tells that story about how Johnny Spaid is never there in his office when he's meant to be. So John Antrimus turns up and he just says, I'll just start writing it. Starts writing this thing, which will eventually be Till Death Us Do Part, this idea that Johnny Spaid already had. So he's developing sort of 10 years before it ever gets anywhere. And the original name for the character of Alf Garnett was going to be?
Alf Ramsey?
It was Alf Ramsey, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So.
So obviously ALS had a stable of very talented writers. Just want to list some of the programs and films and other projects that these people were involved with, you know, from the 50s right up until the last gasp of ALS as we know it. So obviously you've got The Goon Show, you've got Hancock's Half Hour, Educating Archie, Frankie Howard Show, Harry Secombe Show, The Betty Hill Show, Great Scott, It's Maynard, a show called Fred, Son of Fred, Idiot Weekly, The Max Bygraves Show, The Tony Hancock Show, Alfred Marks Time, which was awful, The Case of the Muckinies Battlehorn, The Arthur Haynes Show, which Johnny Spaid wrote until 1966.
Wasn't Arthur Haynes, he might have been Alf Garnett. Wasn't that the story? But then, of course, he dies.
Oh, right. Yeah. The Army Game, The Ted Ray Show, The Jimmy Logan Show, Beyond Our Ken, The Arthur Askey Show, The Running, Jumping and Standing Still film, Sykes and Citizen James, Comedy Playhouse, Bootsy and Snudge, The Anthony Newley Show, Steptoe and Son, That Was the Week That Was, The Tully Goons, of course, Hancock, Doctor Who, of course, Milligan's Wake, The Saint, Round the Horn, Till Death Us Do Part, BBC Three, films like The Big Job, The Bargee with Harry H. Corbett, What a Whopper, The Rebel, which I'm going to watch tonight, actually. I've got the Blu-ray of it, finally. I'm going to watch that tonight. The Spy with a Cold Nose, which was originally offered to Peter Sellers, and it was written by Ray Allen.
Well, that was the story, wasn't it? That after Sellers had his heart attack, and then they go to him with his script, and then he's rolling around on the floor laughing at this script, and they think they're going to kill him again after his heart attack. And then he didn't do the film at the end anyway.
The Plank, and other things like records like, you know, Ying Tong Song, Bridge on the River Wye, just so much that, you know, exemplified 50s and 60s British comedy.
Yes. I know, it is just absolutely enormous, isn't it, really? And that's all coming out of this one organisation. So you think in a different age they would have been a production company, Beryl sort of brings in this guy, Robert Stigwood.
The big change then that came into my life, and indeed several of us, was Robert Stigwood. I wanted to do more production. I just thought it seemed the way to go, and it interested me a lot. And I just thought one could make use of this talent which I was surrounded by. But I didn't have enough money to do it. I was introduced to Robert Stigwood, who I didn't know and he didn't know us. And Robert at that time was very, very involved and very successful in the music business and had major artists like Eric Clapton and the Bee Gees. And then Robert wanted to expand that company into films and television, which he did not know about. And so we ended up that we did do a deal with the Robert Stigwood Organisation, and it completely changed my life.
He merges his agency with NEMS in January 1967, and he, for a time, he looks like someone who could take over from Brian Epstein, but the Beatles did not like him, so they would have nothing to do with him. So that's where if we get handed over to Robert Stigwood, we'll just record, you know, God Save the Queen, you know, over and over again. That's all you'll be getting. Yeah. But it's just interesting, you know, because he is involved with NEMS at this stage, and then he purchases a controlling interest in ALS in 1967. So for your Beatles Goons connections, you know, ALS is almost the thing, which means that the Beatles and the Goons end up as one thing under one organization, you know, very, very nearly. But Beryl was just sort of wanting to kind of expand and do more stuff and films and so on, and that just causes this rift. And so when we did our program 20 years ago on Associated London Scripts, Eric Sykes would not speak to us. So we got rather a one-sided, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. Or sad.
Eric Sykes was so livid by the split that for the rest of his life, he referred to Galton and Simpson as Simpson and Galton.
Really? So did he never speak to them again after that?
I don't think he did. I think he literally never spoke to them again.
Jeez.
I think so, yeah.
Simpson and Galton.
And what about Milligan? What was his...
Well, you see, the thing is, you know, we say this, and this is great riff. So this is about 1967, 68. They split. So that's the end, effectively, of Associated London Scripts, as we've thought of them, as this kind of, you know, powerhouse of comedy script writing, and, you know, all the people you've mentioned, Spike and the Goons and Hancock and Steptoe and Johnny Spade and so on. However, two words for you have cropped up recently on your podcast, Cucumber Castle.
Because
when's that made?
1970.
Yeah. So this is...
Spike's in that.
Yeah, he's in that with... the Beatles wouldn't have...
With Frankie Howard.
Frankie Howard. Beatles wouldn't have anything to do with Robert Stigwood, but luckily there was another group who would, and that was, of course, the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
Cucumber Castle. So Spike is involved, even though that is some years after this supposedly acrimonious split.
Yeah, and Beryl Virtue by this point is managing director of...
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, she's gone from the typist who didn't want to be the typist, and now she just becomes this incredible kind of force in TV and films. And
Men Behave Badly and...
Well, yeah, but, you know, right through, you know, all those films you mentioned, the Steptoe films and just as the Eric Sykes film, isn't there? Which is, again, that's... When was he making that? Because The Plank and all this kind of business.
67, was it? 68?
So, again, it's... Yeah, so it's either around the time of this split or just after.
Yeah.
And yet it is done under the auspices of, you know, Associated London Scripts or Associated London Films or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of spin-off thing is for that. So, you know, that's interesting. But you know, he was a little bit bitter. Anyway, he definitely wouldn't have anything to do with this. I presume we tried to get Norma as well on. Because Norma, again, she'd been Norma Farms, that is, who carries on as Spike's manager for years. She had been part of ALS, and Beryl was trying to persuade her to come with them.
I think
she probably really liked Beryl, but decided to stay with Spike and look after him.
So Spike and Eric and Alan had a meeting, and Spike and Eric were dead against it.
They wanted to stay at Orm Court and do their own thing, you know, which, I mean, they both had, you know, obviously, you know, enormously successful careers, just so they didn't really need it, and they didn't want to lose their independence, you know. I suppose also the way it started in the first place was to avoid being part of another organisation, which is how AAS started. I mean, out of Ray and I's thinking was that it was just doing nothing, stagnating, and it would be a step forward.
Well, I mean, one thing as well I've just remembered, a few years into the 70s, not sure which series of Q it was, Spike wants to do the that sketch with the Daleks.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
And apparently, because obviously Terry Nation held the rights to the Daleks, apparently Terry Nation initially said no to allowing Spike to use them. So the story is that Spike reminded him that he had given him his break and... You know, come on, mate. Bit of payback. So Terry consented. And so the world was gifted the Pakistani Daleks.
Right,
sketch.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's. I don't suppose he called him mate, though.
But yeah, all those Beryl things, you know, The Who with Tommy, isn't that? And let us not forget the Sgt. Pepper film with Bee Gees.
Ooh, and Frankie Howard.
Howard, yeah. There's all those pictures of Frankie and Beryl with Bee Gees. Robert Stigwood signed their contracts or something.
There's so much we could have talked about, and
yes, against us. There is, and I'm sure I had some very important points to throw in at the end, and I've now lost it. What was it going to be? Oh, no, that's it. Yeah. Now, the other thing, so Eric's all very upset about the split, but the thing that I think Alan Simpson remained quite upset about is, you know, this is also all to do with London property prices. Because remember, they've started off with some rooms above a greengrocer's, and then, you know, eventually they moved to Orme Court. And Spike and Eric, as part of their divorce settlement at the end of ALS, they got Orme Court. So ALS owned that. But Eric and Spike got the building, which eventually, I think Spike sold his share to Eric, didn't he, in the end? So Eric owned it outright. So when it was sold in 2022 to, you say, the Kosovo embassy, $6.5 million. Look, so you've gone from some rooms above a greengrocer to it looks like it should be worth more than 6.5. It's not worth 6.5 million, but in ridiculous London property prices, that actually looks like, you know, might have been quite good. It looks absolutely lovely. And what a nice place to have worked all those years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there we are. The story of Associated London Script. So
we've skimmed the surface.
Skimmed the surface. Anyway, there we are. And there is one picture of them, isn't there? Which is on the front of Graham McCann's book of Spike and Eric and Ray Galton and Alan Simpson and Beryl sitting there like she's... And Spike is in, this is the one photograph of them all together, and it must be from about 1955 or something when they all started. And Spike is doing his best to, you know, crazy Spike look. The other four should...
Is that Beryl?
I think it is.
Is that the original typist?
No, I think that's Beryl.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. The other four are going along with it rather reluctantly. I think Alan Simpson just has his head right down. He doesn't want to be associated with this at all. He's just decided to dictate a memo at that moment. Anyway, so an amazing time. An amazing group of people. And there we are.
Absolutely. And as I said, in terms of British comedy history, Associated London Scripps was arguably the most important and influential gathering of talent. Unsurpassed,
yes,
to this day.
You know, it is just extraordinary. It is just amazing figures, and then, you know, some less amazing figures join in. But also, we should just mention. Obviously, there's Graham McCann's book of Spike and Co. A lovely book about all this thing is John Antropos's book, Surviving Spike Milligan. If you find a copy of that, That is very much worth a look. He does at one point say that he got a phone call from Peter Sellers in 1981. So, you know, if he'd had me into some editing on that, I could. Maybe it's through Morris Woodcraft.
So did Michael Bentine. Let's face it.
Yeah, well, that's right. Of course.
All right, Mike. Well, listen, brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. And
no, that is an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me back on.
Fascinating information there. So, and I'm sure you'll come back another time and talk about something equally interesting. So, anything to plug? Anything at all?
I have my Beatles tours around Liverpool. So, get in touch. Come on my Beatles tours. Give me a shout through my website. I don't have a website. What am I talking about? Through Twitter or whatever.
Don't get in contact through his website because it doesn't exist.
It does not exist. If anyone wants to come on one of those, that would be lovely. And we will just see if any of my various films and we've just been trying with my friend Paul Cornwell to get various things off the ground, and no one is buying. We've just not managed to get anywhere so far. So one thing we were trying recently was, you know, the final, you know, speaking of Associated London Scripts, we were trying to get the final Hancock thing off the ground, the final
Hancock, Galton and Simpson project, like one of those kind of film scripts which they wrote up for him and which he didn't do. So, well, you know, it's Hancock's centenary. But no, I think he's gone over the horizon, you know, so none of the TV companies were interested in doing it. So we will try and do something else with it, if possible. It's all marvellous. They will be fine in the end. And if only I had bought Orme Court and had a share in it.
Brad and I had an office in Kensington High Street. And on one occasion, I leaned over too far in my chair and my elbow went through a window and hit an artery and blood spurted dramatically. And Spike Milligan heard my manful screams and rushed in. And he applied an expert tourniquet. And then Brad Ashton drove me to Charing Cross Hospital. And a doctor looked at this wound and kept looking at us very suspiciously and saying, "How did you say you got this injury?" And he said, "This looks like a knife wound to me. Who applied this tourniquet?" And I said, "Spike Milligan," which really made him suspicious. And so I gave him Spike's phone number. And he phoned and said, "Spike, there's a man here who claims that you applied a tourniquet. And his name is Vosburg or Vosburg." And Spike Milligan characteristically said, "I've never heard of the man before in all my life," and hung up.